The EPA administrator under siege, but he still has the backing of the president.
He's a good man. He's done a terrific job.
Talk of a trade war has America's farmers worried an ill wind is blowing.
A 25% tariff is definitely going to disrupt trade.
And Congress could try to undo some of the spending passed a few weeks ago.
And now you're going to dial that back precisely the same way?
It's time to get caught up on what's happened and what's next. With John Decker, Rachel Sutherland, and Chad Pergram, I'm Jared Halpern from Washington. It seems every week there's a new name attached to the speculation of an imminent departure in the Trump administration. This week it fell on Environmental Protection Agency Chief Scott Pruitt, the former Oklahoma Attorney General, who has set his sights on rolling back many of the regulations he opposed during the Obama years. But questions have been raised about Pruitt's travel expenses, raises for staff members, and his living arrangement here in D.C. That was the source of a very contentious interview with Fox News' Ed Henry this week.
I was living out of a suitcase when I transitioned to Washington, D.C. My wife was not with me. My children were not with me. My dog was not with me. And literally, I was traveling kind of with. And what's interesting about this criticism, these same individuals that are criticizing this criticize me for being gone too much, traveling throughout the country. Okay, so you can't have it both ways.
Let's focus on the actual issue. But every cabinet secretary comes here.
No, but
and they're living out of a suitcase. But they rent an apartment at the actual rate.
Yeah, this is the actual rate, and that's what the ethics officials said.
So
and let me say this to you.
Rent Jungle is a website that looks at that, and the average rent in Washington is over $2,000 a month.
Not for what
You're
I rented.
$50 a
Not
night.
For what I rented. Not for what. This was like an Airbnb situation.
Calls for Pruitt's resignation have not just come from Democrats. A few House Republicans have said he should go, but conservative Republicans have stood by Pruitt. They point to his record as EPA administrator, urging President Trump to keep him on the team. And so far, the president seems content to keep Pruitt in place, telling reporters on Air Force One,
"He's a good man. He's done a terrific job."
That comment was followed by a tweet from the president, writing, "Do you believe the fake news media is pushing hard on a story that I am going to replace AG Jeff Sessions with EPA Chief Scott Pruitt, who is doing a great job but is totally under siege. Do people really believe this stuff?" So let's pick it up there with our White House correspondent John Decker. John, what should we believe about Scott Pruitt's future at the EPA?
Well, his future, as Sarah Sanders, the White House spokeswoman, said on Friday, is ultimately up to the president. He's the only person who can fire and hire members of his cabinet. So we don't know the president's thinking on this, other than what he said aboard Air Force One yesterday when taking questions on this and other matters with reporters traveling back from an event in West Virginia. The president indicated that he's very happy with the actual job Scott Pruitt has done as the EPA administrator. That being said, he also expressed some concerns about some of the things that you just mentioned in that introduction, namely the story which has sort of gotten so much attention, and that is the unusual living arrangements that he had, in which he paid $50 a night to stay at the home of a Washington lobbyist for a number of months.
And as we know, sometimes the president saying that you're a good man and doing a terrific job doesn't necessarily mean a lengthy time in office. We've seen the mood
That's
change
right.
pretty quickly.
That's exactly right.
The middle of this week, President Trump met with leaders of the Baltic nations, those countries that border Russia, but are NATO members. And, you know, the president throughout that news avail, that availability with reporters, really pushed back on the idea that he's been soft on Russia. He says nobody has been tougher on Russia than he has been. A little bit of action matched with those words. New round of sanctions that are pretty specific this time around when it comes to some of these business people in Russia.
They are specific. The latest U.S. sanctions target 17 Russian government officials, also seven of Russia's richest men. They're aimed in part at punishing Russia for a number of things, including interference in the 2016 election. And the president's contention that no one has been tougher on Russia than he has an element of truth to it. The president has imposed a number of sanctions, most notably kicking 60 Russian diplomats out of the country, I believe it was last week, in response to that poison attack on a former Russian spy, which occurred on British soil. The problem I think that the president gets into is that he has not been harsh in terms of the rhetoric that he's aimed at Russian President Vladimir Putin. So while the actions may be tough on Russia as a whole, his rhetoric has not been tough on Russian President Vladimir Putin.
Is this latest move, this sort of expulsion of diplomats on both sides here and in Russia, and also this latest round of sanctions, has that imperiled this upcoming meeting between the two leaders? And what is the latest on this soon to be announced, we think, meeting between Presidents Trump and Putin?
The short answer to your question is no, it has not imperiled that meeting. And that question was asked of Sarah Sanders at Friday's White House press briefing. She says one thing has nothing to do with another, that the president very much interested in meeting with a Russian President Vladimir Putin to clear the air and improve relations. The president has spoken about the idea of the need for improving relations with Russia. So that meeting is still on. When it happens, where it happens, we do not know.
I would believe that one of the items that the two presidents would talk about is Syria. President Trump this week said he wants to have U.S. troops quickly withdraw from Syria. That seemed to catch a lot of people off guard. Where did this come from, and where are we in the president being able to announce some sort of withdrawal from Syria?
Well, the president initially made a public announcement of this perhaps policy change while at a campaign event in Ohio. And this followed some conversations that he had been having with his national security team. But after he made that announcement in Ohio, there was another meeting of the National Security Council that the president attended. And they convinced the president that making such a policy change abruptly is not a good thing for bringing stability to that part of the world. Reason being, in the same vein that the president spoke about how ISIS filled the void when the U.S. left Iraq, the same kind of thing could happen in Syria. And so the president has spoken about the need to essentially destroy ISIS before talking about bringing back those U.S. troops there. How many U.S. troops, Jared? 2,000 U.S. ground troops, including special operations forces, are right now in Syria.
The president did campaign a lot on sort of wanting to change U.S. foreign policy. He's called the invasion of Iraq a disaster. He has been very critical of both Republican and Democratic predecessors about the way that they've done this sort of nation building. So it shouldn't be surprising, I suppose, to hear that, you know, once ISIS, as the president says, is eradicated from Syria, he has no interest in having a long-term U.S. presence in that country.
That's right. The president did campaign on that. But also keep in mind what the president said at a primetime speech back in August of 2017. And he was talking about the possibility of withdrawing U.S. forces from Afghanistan. And at that time, in that primetime speech, he said a hasty withdrawal would create a vacuum that terrorists, including ISIS and Al-Qaeda, would instantly fill, just as happened before September 11th. So the president also has that mindset in terms of what to do going forward as it relates to Syria.
Your views change sometimes based on the information that you get, I assume, from commanders, from generals.
Oh, absolutely.
We saw that with President Obama.
That's exactly
during
right.
His presidency.
That's exactly right. President Obama, you know, campaigned about essentially the same thing, bringing all of U.S. troops home from both Iraq and Afghanistan. But, you know, you can't foresee what conditions on the ground may be once you're president. And over the course of your term, President Obama found that out. And I think to a certain extent, President Trump is realizing this as well.
John Decker, again at the White House. Have a good weekend.
Have a great weekend, Jared. Thanks a lot.
Traditionally, farmers need three things to succeed: good land, good weather, and good markets. That third item has many farmers worrying that an ill wind is blowing. President Trump upped the ante with China this week, and now there are growing fears about a trade war. America's farmers, who are in China's crosshairs, fear the tariffs could be devastating.
It's going to hurt livestock. It's going to hurt financial side, the steel.
It's going to hurt agriculture a lot if this plays out and we end up in a trade war.
The president threatened to impose $100 billion more in tariffs on Chinese products in response to Beijing's announcement on tariffs on goods from America's heartland, including pork, fruit, and soybeans, all grown in Trump country. White House trade advisor Peter Navarro says the president has the backs of farmers.
He's directed the Secretary of Agriculture, Sonny Perdue, a great American, to implement a plan immediately to prevent any harm done to our American farmers. And we want to assure you that that plan will be put in place immediately.
I reached out to the USDA with questions about specifics of a plan to protect farmers. They sent a statement without any specifics saying, as we take a stronger approach to the way we handle trade as a nation, we will use all of our authorities to ensure that we protect and preserve our agricultural interests. The American Farm Bureau Federation says they want the United States and China to return to negotiations and produce an agreement that serves the interests of the world's two largest economies. Dave Salmonson is Senior Director of Congressional Relations for the Farm Bureau.
We want these issues solved through more normal processes, through negotiation if possible. We know there are underlying issues. There's a big steel issue, but there are forums to look into that. There's other processes. Of course, representing agriculture, never want to see additional tariffs put on our exports, jeopardize our sales and our future market access, either short-term disruption or long-term disruptions. So we want to see that these be more subject to negotiated processes rather than using tariffs.
What kind of impact could the tariffs have, particularly on pork producers? That's a 25% tariff. What are you hearing from folks who deal in pork?
They're very concerned about that. We sell about $1.1 billion a year of all pork products into China. There were several of the products that were on the list. And a 25% tariff is definitely going to disrupt trade if it lasts for any length of time. And, of course, the length of time on these things is always critical. Then you'll see Chinese buyers looking at that higher price and saying, where else can we go? You've got a lot of the countries in Europe, and you think of countries like Denmark and such, willing to and able to sell pork around the world. A lot of countries in Europe were shut out of the Russian market because of the sanctions. They're desperately trying to find new markets for agricultural products, and pork included. So we'll be facing a lot of competition there that we kind of didn't have before. So that's, I know the industry is very concerned about losing some market share there. And again, once you substitute, will that be more permanent? And the growth that they've had in that market could be shut off for a while.
The Agriculture Department Secretary Sonny Perdue issued a statement saying that they're going to use all of our authorities to ensure that we protect and preserve agricultural interests. What can the USDA do for farmers?
We take the secretary's comments very seriously, and we're thinking about how that could happen if these things, again, take a long period of time. What the USDA can do is probably more of a long-term thing. Say we do lose some share, lose sales into existing markets, well, the USDA can be very helpful of trying to expand into newer markets where we don't have these tariff barriers. Maybe we haven't thought about them as much. You know, we've done that in the past when we had that whole, in the early 2000s, the whole thing with BSE on beef, and we lost markets around the world, especially into Japan for a while. USDA was very helpful then in trying to move products into newer markets, different kinds of products, getting changes in the mixture of what we sold into exports to help the beef industry, and of course worked diligently to try to get that situation resolved, which they did over time. Those are the kind of things that I think USDA can look at. If there is a sharp price downturn for any length of time, then I think producers, depending on the commodity, pork doesn't fit into that because they're not really into a program, though there might be some existing program. There might be some additional, you know, maybe more emergency type help available for those producers through our farm bill type programs. But we'd have to take a hard look at that. They have tools that they could use to help, but we'd all much rather be selling more into markets and growing that way.
Individual farmers could see a hit, but what about consumers? I mean, will they eventually feel a pinch as well?
It's hard to tell what's going to happen on the consumer end. Kind of depends on the product and by the time it's processed and how much of consumer impact there will be. If there would be more product here in the U.S. market that's not being sold, you might expect downward pressure to farmers, especially. They can't sell, they'll get less. Would that translate into any savings on the consumer side and the retail? I have no idea. Too many factors. go into the final price there. The people who are going to feel it first is the entire chain, you know, processors, transporters, shippers, but of course farmers as the producers of product would probably feel it the most.
It almost seems like China's been kind of savvy here, appearing to target America's heartland, a lot of President Trump's base. Does the Farm Bureau have a position on the original steel and aluminum tariffs?
That's the issue that we are concerned that they does not continue. There are a lot of countries that were initially involved in that. Several countries have gotten exemptions. I think Canada, Mexico, Australia, Argentina, Brazil, South Korea have gotten at least temporary exemptions. South Korea has a permanent one due to the new CORUS agreement. But we don't want to see these continue. I mean, there's the thing with retaliation lists that China had, which was focused 25%, as we've said, on pork, 15% on a whole variety of fresh fruits, dried fruits, nuts, you know, apples, cherries, lemons, oranges, all those kinds of things, is they can change. And maybe as time goes by, they'll want a different product mix. Maybe they'll add some other products in. Or duration. Again, we don't know how long this is all going to last. So instead of going down this road, we'd much rather that the two governments got together and were able to find a way to address the steel issue on a long-term basis. It's going to be better for everybody without resorting to these tariffs and retaliation.
What are you telling farmers? I guess you communicate with them. What about the ones who are worried? Do you have a message for them?
People have to tell their concerns, especially to Congress. That's probably the closest to them, their representatives and senators, ways they have into the administration. You know, farmers have, a great rapport with the Department of Agriculture and Agriculture Secretary Perdue and his team. People can communicate, of course, through all of our new platforms that they have into directly to the White House and other officials. So I think people have to make their concerns known and watch this very closely, see how long this lasts, see what any kind of negotiated outcomes, if there are, what that's going to mean, and what potential is for future actions. Again, we want to see this resolved in a negotiated way that works. We don't want to see escalation. We don't want to see new products. But as time goes on, unfortunately, those are the kind of things that can happen in these kinds of trade spats.
Let's talk about the North American Free Trade Agreement. President Trump has long complained about NAFTA, threatening to do away with it.
Well, farmers on NAFTA have been terrific beneficiaries over the 25 years of NAFTA. If you remember back in 93, we sold about $8.9 billion of U.S. ag products annually to Canada and Mexico. Now we're over $39 billion a year. So as NAFTA got rid of tariffs completely with Mexico and mostly with Canada on ag and food products, the volume of trade both ways has really, really grown to the benefit. And a lot of people are dependent on the trade we have with those two countries, especially Mexico's like some of our top markets for all of our products are with Canada and Mexico. In fact, Canada is our number one overall market at over $22 billion a year. Mexico is right around $18 or $19 billion a year, depending on prices and all that. That's our number three export market. So very important. North America is such, again, the biggest single market for all of we do with U.S., Canada, and Mexico for all of U.S. ag products, including the U.S., of course, is here in North America. So very important. We want to see that continue. We don't want to go backwards in anything. There are some benefits we'd like to get. There are remaining tariffs that Canada has on our dairy imports into there. We do have some. But if we could get rid of some of those really high tariffs that Canada has to protect their quota system they have for dairy products, we know we could move more there. So those are the kind of things that we're looking for outcomes, continue the existing structure that we have that's good for us and try to make some changes that'll improve our export potential.
The White House is defending tariffs on aluminum and steel, as well as a threat of more to come, arguing China engages in unfair trade practices and steals American intellectual property. China appearing undeterred, both nations taking shots, raising the specter of a trade war as farmers in Trump country brace for impact.
President Trump says his plan to send National Guard troops to the Mexico border is being put in place, between 2,000 and 4,000 troops, the president told reporters on Air Force One. But there's still a lot of questions that need to be figured out as the federal government coordinates with state officials. During debate over the policy, a story from 20 years ago was brought up. I was reminded about it reading a New York Times article about Ezequiel Hernandez Jr. He was 18 years old when he was shot to death by U.S. Marines on a drug interdiction mission in Presidio, County, Texas. The incident happened about a mile from the border. It's a worst-case scenario that played out, and it has changed U.S. policy about using military assets in the war on drugs. But it does speak about the risk involved for troops and civilians that's inherent in any military deployment, and part of the Pentagon's thinking about this latest effort to use the National Guard to help stem the flow of illegal immigration. Fox News Pentagon correspondent Jennifer Griffin is asking questions and shared the answers she's learned with us. Jennifer, the president says this is going to happen immediately, but obviously this does take some coordination, as we've heard. What is the timeline for how quickly an operation like this can get ramped up?
Well, it's very complicated. And as we've reported, the Pentagon was caught a bit off guard by the president's request. What is happening right now, according to defense officials that I've spoken to, it would take about 2 months before the first National Guard troops would really be down on the border. What's happening right now is that is DHS, Department of Homeland Security, the secretary is reaching out to the governors of the states involved. And what you have are several Republican governors in Texas and Arizona, for instance. But in California, you have a Democratic governor. And it's not clear that Jerry Brown of California wants the National Guard troops to be sent to his border with the Mexican border. So that is all being negotiated right now. This is a complicated process. And once they get down there, it's not clear what their mission is. What Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen said this morning on Fox and Friends was that it would free up the Border Patrol to do more patrolling, more arrests. But in the past, when the National Guard has been deployed along the border by previous presidents, they weren't, for instance, when President George W. Bush sent 6,000 troops, they didn't carry weapons. They weren't allowed to make arrests. And that is that we haven't been able to get a clear answer from the Pentagon. But it's our understanding that there are, of course, laws going back to Posse Comitatus that the federal government cannot send troops to serve in policing actions on U.S. land. So that's why they would go down there and maybe free up the Border Patrol by doing more of the surveillance that, frankly, is already being done. We have U.S. military drones along the border that are part of that surveillance effort. The other thing the president has said is that he would like the U.S. troops to maybe build some of the wall and have the Pentagon use some of its budget to build some of the wall along that border. Remember, he didn't get the $25 billion that he had hoped for to build a wall all along the 2,000-mile border. The military, however, only has one base along that border. It's about 31 miles long at the Barry-Goldwater Air Force Range. So it's possible you'll see a little building going on there, but that's just 31 miles along the 2,000-mile border.
You said that previously when National Guard units were sent down there, they were unarmed. Is that the expectation for these units?
Well, I think it's not clear at this point in time. I think, again, this is going to have to go to the lawyers, and they may find that maybe they want the National Guard to be armed for self-defense. They might be able to justify it in that way. But there may be some legal challenges to this, again, because of this old law that goes back to the post-Civil War period, where the federal government is not allowed to place the U.S. military in a sort of police action on U.S. soil. And really, the biggest question is cost. When President George W. Bush sent 6,000 troops in 2006, it cost $415 million. And at the time, they ended up stripping that money from the Navy and Air Force's operations and maintenance accounts. And those accounts are what the Pentagon was hoping to be using in this upcoming budget to help fix some of the readiness problems and fix some of the aging aircraft and rebuilding the military, which was also a priority of the president.
Yeah, and we've seen the risk associated with failing to do that just this week with this Thunderbird jet, this Air Force jet that went down during a training exercise.
Well, it's not just the Thunderbird's jet. That was the third Thunderbird's plane in 2 years. It was an F-16 that crashed, a very tragic incident involving a very experienced fighter pilot. But what we have also been reporting on is that there have been five non-combat aviation crashes this year alone, killing nine service members. 37 service members were killed in non-combat aviation crashes last year. Those numbers are increasing. Just on Tuesday, a Marine Corps Super Stallion helicopter crashed in Southern California, killing all four Marines on board. So these number of crashes, this spate of crashes has really risen in recent years, and the Pentagon is concerned that some of the readiness problems, some of the lack of training time, maintenance issues from these long extended wars and not keeping up these aircraft has really led to a dangerous situation for these pilots.
You started off this conversation saying that, you know, there could be some resistance, particularly from the governor of California, Governor Brown. Can he stop the National Guard from going to the border between his state and Mexico? Does he have power to say you can't come here?
Yes. The governor, the states have the final say over whether National Guard are activated in their state. It all has to be done in conjunction. You know, DHS can make the request, but the state governors and DHS have to request for the Pentagon to activate the National Guard in those areas. And it's a delicate process. Some of the governors may be willing and would like to have some extra hands down on the border. But as we said, Jerry Brown is a different story. He's already gone head to head with the president on the issue and the Justice Department on the issue of sanctuary cities. So I don't think he's in the mood to compromise right now.
And I guess to circle back to one of the earlier points you made, one of the big question marks is rules of engagement. What are these troops allowed to do under different circumstances?
Absolutely. And in fact, the director of the Joint Staff, Lieutenant General Frank McKenzie, was asked that today at the Pentagon. And again, all of these questions are somewhat premature because they don't know how many troops are being sent, what their assignment will be. Are they going to be, you know, manning drones and in back offices? Are they going to be driving along the border? Are they going to be armed? Are they not? All of these issues are still being worked on and sorted out.
And again, trying to sort of figure out what these troops would be under, what sort of pressures they could face. As you said, it's unknown if they would be, you know, sort of patrolling the border. In a situation like that, we have heard of cases where Border Patrol agents come under some sort of threat, some sort of hostility. Would that be the risk then for these troops that may or may not be armed?
From what we are hearing so far, and again, all of it is being negotiated and sorted out as we speak, it is more likely that these National Guardsmen would serve in a sort of a supporting role, and it would free up the Border Patrol from desk jobs and to get them out patrolling the border. So you would still have Border Patrol officers out there. One of the things that President George W. Bush and President Obama used the deployment of the National Guard to do, it freed up the Border Patrol to train more Border Patrol because they were finding they needed to surge the training of the Border Patrol. And so it's possible that the National Guard would be sent there to, again, free up the Border Patrol. But again, it's really all of this is being discussed. And, you know, often these things are discussed and then rolled out to the press and to the nation. But it sort of works in reverse right now with the current administration.
Jennifer, I appreciate the time helping us figure out exactly what it is these men and women in uniform are going to be asked to do. By now, if you've been listening to this podcast for a while, you know well inside the Beltway words like sequestration, cloture, maybe even non-germane. Well, for many of us, a new word was added to our Capitol Hill vocabulary this week, rescission. It's one way the Republican-led Congress may attempt to roll back some of the spending it okayed a few weeks ago in that $1.3 trillion omnibus bill, the one President Trump threatened to veto but signed with a warning he won't sign similar legislation ever again. That's where I started this week's chat with our senior Capitol Hill producer, Chad Pergram. So, Chad, let's start with the new Capitol Hill vocabulary word I learned this week, rescission.
Rescissions. Rescissions are basically spending cancellations. I remember that there was a rescissions bill in 1994. I remember that there was a rescissions bill in late 1993, and what happened was that House and Senate Democrats approve President Clinton's big economic stimulus plan, and then they realize they needed to dial that back a little bit. They had some heartburn. And so under the Budget Act of 1974, which controls the budget process, within a month and a half, you can go back and repeal some of those individual spending appropriations that have been approved. Now, it has to be very targeted. And the problem that Republicans are going to have here is that it was quite a balance beam, Jared, to pass this big economic government funding bill a couple of weeks ago. Well, the fact that they had to make the calculus so specific to put certain programs in there to get both Democrats and Republicans on board, and now you're going to dial that back precisely the same way? I mean, that's hard to believe.
Right. And it brings up a few other points. Obviously, the president was very reluctant when he signed this more than $1 trillion spending bill, for a few hours at least, threatened to veto the measure, which would have shut down the government, because I think there were actually planes like in the air with members of Congress on them.
Yes, absolutely.
they were gone. They had voted on this. They were not coming back. So a rescission bill would sort of cancel some of that spending.
Right.
But it would take 60. I mean, it would go through the regular legislative process,
right? Well, it takes 51 at the end of the day. That's the advantage. Now, let's look at the House of Representatives. First of all, you're probably not going to have Democrats help on this. Number two, they're going to threaten to blow up the appropriations process, the spending process in the next round, because remember in February, what set the table for this budget agreement was the spending cap deal in February. And they're going to say, wait a minute, we agreed to that, and now you're going to go back on that. But keep in mind, you have to get this with Republican votes. Now, probably if they're able to get the president in line on this and the Republican leadership, they can probably do this with Republicans only. It has to go through the Appropriations Committee. There's nobody that likes to spend money any better than appropriators. There's the old line here on Capitol Hill that there's three types of members of Congress. There's Democrats, Republicans, and appropriators. They control the spending process. So this bill has to originate in the Appropriations Committee. But here's the rub. Could you have people in the Freedom Caucus, the Conservative Freedom Caucus, say, we like this idea of cutting spending, but why not cut more? And they object and aren't willing to vote for this, and then you just lack the votes to get it done. The Senate, it is a narrow path because, again, you effectively only have 50 votes right there. The Republicans have 51, but down to 50 with John McCain being out. But you could see where a rescissions vote could be weaponized in the Senate and maybe even have a little bit of a better chance of passing in the Senate if moderate Democrats who face competitive re-elections get on board. It would be hard to see how someone like Joe Donnelly from Indiana or Joe Manchin from West Virginia or Heidi Heitkamp from North Dakota wouldn't be for a bill that cuts spending. That would be pretty amazing.
The details, of course, would always matter. It would matter what programs are being cut, because right. To your point, this was a long negotiated process between Republican leaders and Democratic leaders to end the sequestration. They wanted to raise spending caps on the defense side and on the domestic side. Democrats and Republicans sort of found that, to your point, balance. Presumably, the spending cuts that would come from a measure like this would not be on the defense side of the ledger, right?
Absolutely. And that's what they needed to get Democratic buy-in on that bill. There were significant chunks of Democrats, even more Democrats, who voted for the bill in the Senate than they did in the House. But like I say, you can turn this against those Democrats in the Senate in a way you can't turn it against those Democrats in the House.
The other thing that President Trump said that, and this isn't a new wish from the president, is the Senate getting rid of the filibuster, the legislative filibuster, the nuclear option, which was put in place several years ago, first by the Democrats to push through
2013.
To push through these nominations, and then sort of expanded by Mitch McConnell, the Republicans, to get Gorsuch through, the Supreme Court nominee. But there is no appetite, right, to end the filibuster on legislation, to lower the threshold from 60 votes to 51 for legislation.
A year ago this month, after Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, muscled through Neil Gorsuch onto the Supreme Court by not changing the Senate rules, changing the precedent. The precedent. The Senate works on rules, and then there's precedent. And so they were able to change the precedent, which isn't as challenging. It is a challenge, but it's not as challenging as changing the Senate rules. I asked Mitch McConnell, I said, is there any appetite to change the legislative filibuster? And he said no. A year later, it doesn't look like there is. Again, it comes back to the math. The math is unmutable on Capitol Hill. If the Republicans are effectively only working with 5-0 votes right now, you could see very easily where some people are absent, Maybe they lose a special election, or God forbid, Senator McCain passes away and the seat flips. I mean, you could see all sorts of things. And then the Democrats, guess what? They're going to pass their gun control bill their way. They're going to pass their DACA fix their way, because the Republicans wouldn't be able to stop them on anything, because you don't have that 60 vote threshold needed to break a filibuster. And people on the Republican side are very mindful of that. Maybe not the president, but Republican senators are.
How come the Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, has not filed for re-election yet?
The short answer is, and I just spoke with a source about this the other day, because they say that they're not sure that he knows exactly what he wants to do. Now, there's been a lot of chatter in Washington, D.C., and apparently in Western Nevada, Mark Amade is a Republican congressman from there who said that there was going to be a change in the speakership in a month or two. And Steve Scalise, who was the whip who was shot at the baseball practice last June, was going to matriculate, jump over Kevin McCarthy, the majority leader, and be the Speaker of the House. A lot of people do think that Paul Ryan will recalibrate and evaluate where he is if Republicans maintain the majority. There's probably a better chance that he stays. If that's not the case, they don't have the majority, he probably leaves. Don't forget that he represents an R+5 district, meaning it only favors Republicans by 5 points in a swing state, Wisconsin, where there was a semi-bellwether race just a couple of days ago for the state Supreme Court that went Democratic. You know, even when he was the vice presidential nominee in 2012, Jared, he only got 55% of the vote. You would think that you would at least run up the scoreboard to 60. And because he's been the Speaker of the House now for a couple of years, you get a bigger target on your back. People come after you. And so some people think that, you know, he could lose at the ballot box. Now, that is not a done deal. There have only been two speakers of the House who have lost their election. Tom Foley in the landslide in 1994. And again, some people think that this is a big Democratic wave coming, and that's what Tom Foley got caught up in. And Galusha Grow, who was a speaker in 1862 from Pennsylvania, Republican, who lost. So it's rare for a speaker to lose at the ballot box. But a lot of people are thinking, OK, Paul Ryan might reevaluate where he is, and if they lose the House, might decide to move on.
You mentioned the fundraising. I know that Speaker Ryan, to your point, has a big target on his back because he's Speaker of the House. But is there anybody that Republicans have, aside from President Trump, who can raise money, particularly in these House districts, like Speaker Paul Ryan?
It goes with the office. It goes with the office. I mean, look at Nancy
so
Pelosi.
Him stepping out before the election.
That's not real wise. That's not real wise. And again, you know, it makes it hard to run on tax reform, which was this big issue that the Republicans have been pushing as kind of their signature topic going into the midterms. It just jumbles things tremendously. And that's why a lot of people think it could be in the offing later down the road, but maybe just not yet.
It's going to be a big hearing with Mark Zuckerberg.
There's going to be two big hearings with Mark Zuckerberg. He goes before the Senate Commerce and Judiciary Committees, a joint hearing first, and then he goes to the House Energy and Commerce Committee. That's going to be kind of the number one marquee event of Capitol Hill.
A lot to look forward to as Congress returns from spring break. Chad, looking forward to running those halls with you once again.
And I can tell you this, I'm pretty sure that Galusha Grow did not have a Facebook profile.
That will do it this week for the From Washington podcast. As Chad said, the premier event next week, those Facebook hearings featuring Mark Zuckerberg himself Tuesday and Wednesday. Those will happen the same time the social media giant is reaching out to the 85 million Facebook users, the company says, had information collected by political research firm Cambridge Analytica. President Trump will make his first visit in office to Latin America, traveling at the end of the week to Peru for the Summit of the Americas with other Western Hemisphere leaders. We'll be watching to see if he has any interaction with Cuban leader Raul Castro. The president will then travel on to Colombia. Of course, so much can happen between now and our next podcast, so the best way to stay up to date is our top of the hour newscast, either right on your radio or the Fox News Radio app. You can also use Amazon's Alexa, Apple Siri, and Google Play. Just ask for Fox News or for your favorite Fox News Radio podcast, like this one from Washington, or the Fox News Rundown. For all of us at Fox News Radio, I'm Jared Halpern from Washington.